Why should the people trust a queen who can't keep her promises?
If I could do what Ramsay did to you, I would.
I will not kneel before some barefooted commoner and beg his forgiveness.
John's taking a risk, but he has to. We don't stand a chance otherwise.
My ancestors would spit on me if I broke bread with a crow.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. This week, we are going to give an in-depth autopsy and examination to Season 5 of Game of Thrones on HBO and the books that inspired the show. And I am joined to talk about it by my semi-regular co-host for such topics, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard the White Rocket Show, John.
Glad to be here, Vin.
Now, this is a topic that is of particular interest to both of us. We both are longtime book readers going way, way back. What year did you first... I have a few announcements to make, but first let me just ask you, because I can't remember now. What year do you think you probably first started reading the books, the George R. R. Martin books?
It was in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. I have to go back and look. I mean, 2003, somewhere in there, sounds right. I probably went back and started reading the series then.
I just couldn't remember if you read them first or if I read them first, because it seems like we were both reading them by the time we found out that we were both reading them. I don't think one of us told the other. We were both in. Yeah, I started around 2001, 2002. I started when the third book, Storm of Swords, had just come out in hardcover. So I have the first two in little small paperback. Well, there's nothing small about them, but you know what I mean, the mass market paperback. And I have the third one in hardcover, the fourth one in hardcover, and then I have the fifth one actually on Kindle. And I've read through some of it, but about as much as I'm probably going to. Before we get into our in-depth discussion, and by the way, spoiler warning, if you haven't watched Season 5, which would be the most recent season that just completed its run a couple of weeks ago, if you haven't watched it, or if you haven't read the last two books, I guess, then you would certainly want, if you don't want to be spoiled, then go off and do that, and the show will still be here when you get back. Some quick announcements. First, I've got to point out, this is the first White Rocket episode that we have done for July of 2015, and this month marks the 10th anniversary of White Rocket Books and White Rocket Entertainment. 10 years ago, July. It was July of 2005. The whole thing got started when I was sitting on the beach in Singapore, and I was thinking about some people I'd been talking to in the publishing industry before I'd moved away from the U.S. for a while. And I was sitting there thinking that wouldn't it be cool to bring a bunch of authors and editors and artists together and start up a sort of a co-op, a publishing co-op where we all edit, we all write, we all contribute art and all that. It never really worked out quite that way, although there have been a number of artists, a number of writers, a number of editors to come and go. I've kind of been the mainstay through it all, and I'm proud of that. We started this podcast back in 2012 out of that. But 10 years of White Rocket, I'm pretty excited. I also wanted to point out that the Summer of Zelazny that we've talked about on previous episodes has only gotten started. There is more to come. I'm going to have Sean Michael Vogt on pretty soon to complete the discussion of the third, fourth, and fifth Amber books. So don't despair. We will get that out to you pretty soon. And also, you may have noticed, I believe it was episode 71 of this show. This show has been nominated for a Parsec Award for general entertainment discussion type shows. We're up against probably a dozen or so others that have been nominated. And I was asked to send in a 10-minute excerpt of up to three episodes highlighting the last year. And so I think if you go and look at episode 71, you can listen to the 10-minute highlights. I went ahead and posted it so that you can hear it too. And I'm pretty pleased. It's got Grant, a little bit of Graham McNeil. It's got a little bit of James Palmer talking about the Hugo Awards. And it's got, what was the middle one? Andrew Gaska talking about Space 1999 at Dragon Con. Of course, how could I blank out on that? Right. So I think it's a pretty interesting and entertaining little 10-minute excerpt show. One last note of personal reference that I'll mention again at the end is I have a new novel out called Baranak Storming the Gates. And this is the prequel to Lucian Dark God's Homecoming. And it is the sixth novel in the Shattering series. So it's on Amazon. It's in Kindle. It's in hardcover. It's in paperback. All you got to do is just go to www.whiterocketbooks.com or go to amazon.com. And you should find it under my name pretty easily. All right. That's the preliminary material out of the way. John, let's see. The fifth season of Game of Thrones, before we get into specifics, what are sort of your overall positive, negative impressions about this season compared to other seasons? What's been happening in it and the controversies, maybe?
I guess in the big picture, I didn't enjoy this season as much as some of the other ones. And I think some of it is that, you know, as a book reader, one of my favorite parts of the show is kind of following along with the book as we get to certain parts. And we quickly in this season ventured off in unknown territory for book readers, which was a little bit disconcerting. And also, I think there were genuinely episodes this season in the middle where the show kind of, you know, plodded along a little bit. And then it really kicked up a couple notches. And then we had the great Hard Home episode, which is really kind of the peak of the whole season, probably. And the other part is I think, you know, it didn't have a gigantic – Hard Home was, you know, I think clearly a highlight episode, and it had the big stuff in the finale. But I think there were some middle episodes of the season that weren't as good. But overall, it was great, and I'm interested to see where the story goes. And it's exciting to be, you know – running out of book material, basically.
Yeah, you're getting to kind of discover now about like what I was experiencing at the beginning of the season and what non-book readers were experiencing from the very beginning. See, from the beginning, I knew everything that was going to happen through the first, you know, four seasons. And my wife watching it with me didn't know anything. And so she was surprised. And I was like, yeah, there's that. and then I decided once the show started not to read any more of the books until the show was over so I could actually enjoy the show and get some surprises. And so this whole season, to some degree, I mean, there's been some things I remember from A Feast for Crows, but all the Dances with Dragons stuff was new to me. But yeah, toward the end, there was stuff you didn't know anything about, huh?
Nope. It's several plot lines. They've left the books behind entirely And it's things I assume are going to happen in the books, but there's no guarantee they are. So
no guarantee. Well, what do you think about that? Before we get into more specifics, what do you think about the whole? I mean, they had to do something, right?
Yes.
Because he doesn't crank these out like a pulp writer. He's not like the guy that used to write Doc Savage and have five typewriters going at once, you know, 24 mm-hmm. hours a day, or the guy that wrote The Shadow or whatever it was. There was one pulp writer that had multiple typewriters on this great long table, and he would just had a rolling chair, and he would just go and then roll the next one. George just like sips it like a fine wine, doesn't he?
He does, and it, you know, we've talked about this in our big Game of Thrones podcast, but I have real concerns that he's going to do the Robert Jordan on us, and he's not going to finish the series before he passes away, and that would be disturbing. But you know, it's going to come out when it comes out, but it's exciting. And I'm, you know, part of me at what, you know, I've always feel like I'm the kind of person, like I'd always rather read the book than watch the movie first. And so it was tough for me to say like, okay, I'm just going to have to go all in and watch the TV shows. And then whenever the books come out, I'll go back and read them and see what the differences are.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it is interesting because I think the first few seasons, they played pretty close to the show. I mean, here's the thing. You had to have read the books very recently and really pay close attention to the early seasons to see the differences. And, you know, I read them once and I never felt the desire to go back and read them again. In fact, I did. It's funny. I tried to listen to the audiobook of the first book over again later, and I got so frustrated with Ned Stark and his idiocy that I just bailed out because I wanted to scream at him. No, you idiot. You're ruining your whole family. Stop doing what you're doing. So, well, I had several very strong opinions about this season and what's happening in it too. And what do you think about, well, I mean, I think that the thing that most people talk about and it's kind of come up the most controversially by the end, and there's several things, but one of them is the killing of the characters. I mean, I know that's kind of his thing now. It's his shtick. He's like, I'm the kill all your favorite characters guy. Ooh. And I know that's his thing. I get it. But am I supposed to like that? Is that supposed to be a positive? How am I the viewer, the reader, supposed to react to this? Am I supposed to say, oh, he killed my favorite character again? What high art? I must celebrate the craftsmanship of this. Or am I supposed to say, dang it, I'm sick of this. How am I supposed to feel? Help me out.
I think it's more the latter. But the other thing I think to me is that as the reader or the viewer, it really makes you care about the characters that are left that you care about, and you fear for them when in a situation. Because there's a lot of shows and a lot of movies where you're like, there is no way this character's dying. I don't care how probable it is. James Bond is not dying in the next Inspector.
Right.
But, you know, Jon Snow, nobody thought he was going to die, but he's got stabbed 20 times or whatever at the end of that episode. And I don't think he's gone, but I think he's dead. And the same thing with Ned, same thing with, Rob, same thing with all these other characters we cared about. And, the characters you didn't like, Joffrey or Tywin or those kind of people too, or Daenerys's brother, but Khal Drogo. But some of it is, so that when there's a character that you care about on the screen, whether it's Daenerys or Arya or whoever, that you do worry about them. And there is real concern, real worry, because it's not beyond him to kill these people. But also I think maybe he is reaching a point where it's like, okay, it's a little bit much. And it has to serve some purpose in the larger story. Part of it is to show what a terrible world they live in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
When the people that are trying to do the good things or the right things are the ones that keep getting wiped out, not just the bad people. Here's one question is, does it make you enjoy the story less?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah, you make a good point. Here's what I've noticed. The characters that are, it's kind of like if you take Dungeons and Dragons and how it divides up good and evil. There's like lawful good and chaotic good and neutral and then lawful evil and chaotic evil and all that, right? It's like if you are a lawful good character, you're a dead man walking on this show. If you're chaotic good, in other words, if you're kind of pragmatic, you're trying to do the right thing, but in whatever pragmatic way works,
yeah,
then you got a lot better chance of staying alive, like a Tyrion or John up until this point, although he was kind of more, he ultimately was lawful good. And Ned Stark is the best example. Ned Stark was Mr. Lawful Good, and you saw what that got him. I was going to say, I look back at the deaths of the big heroic characters, And I was sad when I read the book and saw Ned get killed at the end of the first book. Looking back now, I'm like, well, yeah, obviously. I mean, knowing what we know now, he never had a chance. He was dead from the jump. Whereas Rob, that one surprised me a little bit more, and John truly surprised me. The only thing that's a saving grace is that Martin has been killing off the really evil characters too. It's sort of like the characters in the middle are the only ones that are remotely safe. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If you're really good or really evil, you're dead. But if you're kind of in that gray area, then the capricious god of Martin finds you kind of more interesting and you stay alive longer.
Well, and that's honestly one of the other things I love about this show is that, you know, the characters that are in that gray area, they have these huge redemption kind of stories or change of maybe they started out as a bad guy, now they're a good guy. And I think Jamie is the great example of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the character. I mean, you're introduced to them when he's having sex with his sister and he throws a small child out a window.
Out the window, trying to kill him.
Yes. And so that's what you – and that he's incredibly arrogant in those first few episodes. So you see, gosh, I hate this guy. But you also see that he's good to his brother. And and over time you see that he's actually a good to be a knight, and his nickname that everybody calls him, the Kingslayer, he actually saved everybody in the city from being burned alive by Mad King Aerys, who was going to set the whole city on fire, and Jaime killed him to prevent that. But nobody knows that, and no one will ever believe it. So he's just this derogatory guy who was supposed to be guarding the king and killed him, when in fact he should be hailed as a knight and a savior of the kingdom. But
yeah, it's funny, the ones that started out kind of evil have become more good, and the ones that were so innocent and good to begin with have had to become more pragmatically not evil, but pragmatically willing to walk on the edges. I mean, Arya is clearly the example of that. I mean, she was just an innocent little girl. And the changes that have had to happen to her are just horrific almost. She's had to, it's just depressing. And this takes me back to the sort of that original question, which is, are we supposed to be enjoying this? I mean, I said something on Facebook about how I'm just not sure at this point after season five, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to be enjoying this as a pleasant diversion and entertainment. And somebody's response was, well, open yourself to art, Van. I'm like, well, that's like, John, that's like you and me watching the 85 Auburn Alabama game and seeing Van Tiffin kick that 52-yard field goal to beat Auburn. And we should look at each other and say, we should open ourselves to the artistic beauty of that kick. No, it was horrible. It ripped my guts out. And I'm not. At what point does something quit being art and start being hitting yourself hard in the head with a hammer?
Well, that's the question. It's like, is it – Martin is going to have to – he's got probably, two books left and, two TV seasons left, potentially three, to bring this whole thing home. And he's got to move quickly and decisively. And there's got to be some characters doing some great things down the stretch here to make it worth all the carnage and all the pain that we went through at this point. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you think this story is going to have a happy ending?
Well, that's a great question. I think you have to define happy. And in George R. R. Martin's universe, happy will be when the last dragon bites off the head of the last walker guy.
Whether any humans are left alive or not at that point?
I don't know. I mean, that looks like the finish to me. It looks like what we're building toward is like it's going to be the ice people are going to come down from the north, and the people from Easteros or whatever, Essos, will come over the narrow sea, and there will be a big world war in Dorne. And the last dragon will fight the last ice warrior, whatever they're called. What are the White Walkers. Yeah, that's right. The White Walkers. Yeah. So
Well,
I don't know. Do you think that it'll have a happy ending? What do you think? And how do you define a happy ending on this show?
I don't think there's going to be a fairy tale happy ending. I really don't. I think, you know, it may be a, you know, all the characters you care about go down fighting in some heroic last stand that ends up saving the world, but they're all dead at the end or something. Let's review, you know, where did George R. Martin come from? He was like a writer for horror movies and TV shows or whatever. So,
among
other things. And I think there's some of that potential down the stretch here. So,
Well, there were several characters that had pretty big arcs in this season. And I think that one that was most interesting was Stannis. So talk a little bit about how you feel about Stannis's arc over this season.
Sure. And I'll talk about him versus the TV show versus the books. I mean, in the TV show, you know, Stannis started out at the wall. He took his army. He marched toward Winterfell and that, you know, it started snowing heavily. Things got bad. Ramsay Snow Bolton led a little group up there and burned some of their tents and, cost them a bunch of their food and stuff. They had to eat the horses and everything. And then Stannis kind of loses hope and Melisandre suggests he burn his daughter and he does it, which was really the point when a lot of people said, we're out on you now. And so at that point, then Stannis' army was out of horses and Melisandre left and his wife hung herself. And then he walked the rest of the army towards Winterfell and got wiped out by the Boltons, basically. So,
which was hilarious because he had half his army left. He had sacrificed his daughter for nothing. And you're just like, at this point, it's a tall order to make the Boltons more sympathetic than you.
That's right. Because believe me, I can't wait for those people to get eaten by the White Walkers.
Oh, yeah.
And Stannis certainly made them look sympathetic this year. And I, you know, the whole killing his daughter thing, I think they really rushed it through. In the books, his daughter is still at Castle Black with his wife and Melisandre and isn't even with the army. So the whole burning thing hasn't happened in the book. That was another big shocker to all the book readers. And so maybe it happens, but there's got to be 100 other bad things that happen to Stannis before I will believe that that character would go there.
Right.
Maybe Melisandre and the wife do it without him or something, you know, or something else happens. But Stannis seems like the kind of guy who – he's clearly a guy who doesn't give up easily. And to think that he would go immediately from the first one or two bad things happen to let's burn my daughter. The other thing with this whole Stannis arc is it's all based on the premise that he is the person that's supposed to fulfill this prophecy. And that's what Melisandre sees in him, that he is this hero of legend who's come back to save us, and that combined with being the rightful king means she should help him. But the reality is, you know, she's misinterpreting the prophecy, and it's not Stannis, and that's why she does all these things to help him. But at the end, she abandons him and goes back to Castle Black, where she's conveniently there when Jon Snow gets stabbed.
Right. Was she there at the books, in the books?
Yes, in the book she stays at Castle Black and she's there. Okay. So I think either way, I mean, we can move on. I mean, tell me, I know you were very disturbed by the Stannis arc. So tell me what you think about Stannis before we move on and talk about Jon.
Well, see, I'm predisposed for a couple of reasons. One, he is without a doubt the most legitimate claimant on Westeros to the throne.
Yes.
I mean, if you line up everybody that's not Dany, he's number one, in my opinion, even ahead of Renly, because he was older than Renly. I never understood why people lined up behind Renly. I mean, you know, when Stannis was still alive.
You think it's some kind of legal issue?
Huh?
You were correct. In a legal sense, if the Supreme Court of Westeros were going to decide this issue, he would win. But that doesn't have anything to do with it.
Right. Renly was more popular, I guess, or something? Or
yes. Stannis is a boring pain in the rear end, and people would much rather follow Renly. So.
Okay. Well, The other thing is, I like the actor that played Stannis because I, you know, he played Thomas Jefferson in the John Adams miniseries on HBO, and I really enjoyed that. And I loved his sort of understated performance. So I'm predisposed to kind of want to root for Stannis, and I wince every time he does something bad. We don't know that Brienne, they very cleverly didn't show us anybody really hardly actually dying at the end of this season. They just suggested it. And I was really wanting the Onion Knight to come back from Castle Black, find out Stannis had burned his daughter, and he kill him.
No, that's the other thing is the Onion Knight could not be there because you could not tell me that he would stand by.
Oh, no.
No way.
No way. No way. Right. He had to, and he knew that. Stannis knew that. That's why he sent him off.
Mm-hmm.
When Stannis burned the daughter, I put George R. Martin and the TV show both on probation. I told them, you now have an ankle monitor. You're being watched very carefully. You better not do anything else stupid and affrontish to me, if that's a word.
Sure.
That brings us to the next point. Jon Snow. This is where they violated probation, and they are now hanging by a thread with me. So tell us a little bit about the Jon Snow arc and how the book compared to the show and what we should take from all that.
Well, I think in both the book and the show, the big thing with Jon Snow is he's Lord Commander, and not all his men trust him because he did cross over and live with the wildlings for a while with Ygritte and all that. So he still has some trust issues with some of the Night's Watch. And then he comes up with this plan to invite the wildlings through the wall to the south side to help the Night's Watch fight against the White Walkers. And his feeling is, and he says this a lot, we're the sword in the darkness that guards the realms of men and their men. Even if they, you know, we fought against them, that was just, you know, skirmishing or waiting for the real war to come. But the Night's Watch, a lot of the people in it don't see it that way. They see the wildlings as the real enemy. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the other lords in the north see it that way too. So John goes, you know, in through these plans to bring the wildlings south of the wall, and in the TV show, that, you know, the big thing was he went to Hardhome to pick up a bunch of them in the ships, and that led to the big fight there, which we'll get into later. But the bottom line is, in both of them, in both the TV show and the books, eventually the brothers in the Night's Watch had enough, and they basically backstabbed him. It was kind of a Caesar et tu Brute thing where they all took turns stabbing him, saying for the watch. And it happens at the end of the most recent book, basically a chapter or two before the end and at the end of the TV show. And so he's laying on the ground in both. It does. In either one, are we sure he's dead? And I will tell you, I think he's going to die, but I think he's coming back.
And how will he come back?
Well, there's a couple. There's three options, really.
Okay.
I think for Jon Snow to come back, and one is he could warg into Ghost, and he could be his soul, his spirit could be in Ghost. Okay, for a while, and then maybe Melisandre or somebody else could bring it back into his body. Okay. Another option is Melisandre could raise him from the dead in the same way that we saw Beric Dondarrion, the Lightning Lord, come back when he was leading the Brotherhood without banners in, I don't know, season two or three.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, but it flashed by so fast on the TV show. If I hadn't read it in the book, I wouldn't remember it at all.
That's right. But so in the TV show, they actually made Melisandre visit them and watch that. So she knows it's possible.
Okay.
So that thread is clearly there. The other one is Jon Snow could come back as some kind of good White Walker, basically a good white. In the same way, there's a character in the books called Cold Hands, which is basically a white that's a good guy. I mean, he's a dead person, but he's a good guy, and he actually helps Sam and Gilly when they're trying to get away, and then he helps Bran and his friends when they're trying to get north of the wall to visit Three-Eyed Crow. So I think one of those three scenarios will happen, and John will come back. And the interesting thing about that is once he's died, he's released from his obligation of the Night's Watch because you serve until death. So then when he comes back, is he still in the Night's Watch or is he out?
Now he can go and fight for Winterfell theoretically?
Theoretically.
Without having to be tied down to...
And the other thing is, you know, while he's recovering or whatever, you got to think the Wildlings and the Night's Watch are going to, you know, whatever is left of Stannis' people, those three groups are going to wipe each other out.
Well, it seems to me like at this point, those two groups each have about 12 people in it.
No, there's thousands of both of them, but they're going to wipe it. My prediction is they're going to wipe each other out, and when things are at their worst and then winter picks up, that's when the White Walkers are going to attack.
And there's not going to be anybody left, and they're just going to climb over the wall or whatever. And
yep.
And it's going to fall to Cersei to send her new Frankenstein monster out to fight the White Walkers.
We'll get to that, but that's the other part of the show, and then we could talk about the Hardhome thing in a minute. But that the idea that the real danger is out there, and you've seen it now, and all this other stuff with fighting for the Iron Throne doesn't matter.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, from the very beginning, it seemed that way, because they've shown us the White Walkers from the very beginning of the show. It was like the very first thing we ever saw on the show.
I know, but then you go away from it for so long, stuff with Tyrion and all the other people in King's Landing, and Joffrey and Sansa, and you think, wow, this is really what's going on. But in the big picture, doesn't matter because they could all get wiped out.
Well, they're rapidly running out of characters that I'm really rooting for. Arya's in deep trouble and suffering, and Tyrion's a drunk now, although he does get to rule a new kingdom, basically. And all I've got left besides that is Dany, but now she's off kind of spinning her wheels again. This never goes anywhere over there. So I guess I'm supposed to care about Sansa Stark, but I don't. So let's talk a little bit about her arc, because interesting, that was the two big controversial moments. It's funny, the people that really objected so hard to Sansa's storyline in, let's see, it was the end of maybe episode 6 or 7 that ended with the infamous rape scene, you know, with Bolton, Ramsay Bolton. A lot of people checked out of the show after that, and I kept wondering, oh gosh, if those people had stuck around longer, they'd have seen the little girl get burned alive. I wonder what they'd have thought about that. Because I thought that was much worse, you know? I mean,
it was.
So
they were both horrible, but the other thing with Sansa is can't happen overnight, but at some point you want her to become someone that, you know, is not the victim all the time.
Right.
She's been the victim, you know, through 5 seasons now, basically.
Yeah.
And has had very little control over her own actions and what happens to her. And at some point, you just want her to get some loyal people around her, and then where she could maybe start controlling events. And I don't even know if she's ever going to get payback in the way that Arya is going to get payback. But at least, you know, you think my idea is that maybe Sansa has learned enough from being around, you know, the court in King's Landing and being around Littlefinger enough that she could be somebody who could manipulate events and, you know, maybe do some things.
End up eventually like the Queen of Thorns, kind of as a world-wise, you know, I've been through the crap and I've learned. But see, what's worse for her character, kind of the way she comes across, is that she's up and she's held in contrast against what Dany is doing, what Arya is doing, and even what Brienne is doing. And so Sansa ends up just looking weak by comparison to them. And every time you think, well, that'll change her, that'll get her, you know, to become tougher and more wily and pragmatic and everything. No, she ends up right back in another unfortunate situation. And it's very frustrating. So I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about Sansa.
It's true. I mean, it really felt like after last season, maybe she was headed towards learning something. And let's be clear, the arc with her marrying Ramsay Bolton is not in the books. Or it hasn't happened in the books yet.
Right. He marries like a fake Arya, right?
That's right. They fake an Arya to fool everybody, and that's who he marries.
Okay.
And that's who Theon jumps off the wall with.
The Arya girl?
The fake Arya, yes.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that. So when he, is that the last time we see them in the book is when they jump off the wall?
Oh, yeah.
So what are we supposed to think happened to them when they jumped off the wall?
Well, actually, I think in the books, they jump off the wall and then they may even link up with Stannis. I can't remember.
I wasn't sure if we were supposed to think that they died, or were we supposed to think that there's like a cart full of hay with no pitchfork in it, or are we supposed to think that
I think there's like 10 feet of snow down there or something.
Okay. Or maybe Ramsay parked his marshmallow shipment there.
No, I think they landed like 20 feet of snow or whatever.
Okay.
So.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. What about, let's see, talk about some of the differences. I remember that one of the books, maybe the fourth one, made a big deal out of suddenly getting all into the Ironborn and talking about all their ins and outs. And I felt like that just came out of nowhere and I didn't care. I didn't want to know anything about them. I wanted to get back to stuff I was more interested in. And I give Martin credit for making it interesting, but it just went on and on with all this stuff about a family that honestly, Theon's the only one of any real consequence, it seems like. So, tell us a little bit about why we should care about the Ironborn and if we should see them on the show or not, because they didn't show up this season, did they?
They didn't show up at all, and you know, in the book at this point, they're basically they're Theon's father, the king, died over there. They're, you know, Balon Greyjoy, and they basically have a king's moot, a meeting to pick a new king. And in the books, they end up picking the king's one of the king's younger brothers. Who's actually a dastardly pirate named Euron Greyjoy.
Oh, I've heard of him. Yeah, okay.
He has a very bad reputation.
I believe they've tried to cast him now for next season, so we may be seeing him.
They have. So I think that whole plot line's coming back with him, and I think that's going to be interesting. And they're going to do some damage, I think. So they're not done yet. The other big one that the storyline that came into this season was, what did you think about events in Dorne?
That was just odd. I mean, apparently it's a country of about 7 people and everybody in the entire country lives inside a little preserve there with, the doctor from Star Trek Deep Space Nine as the king or the prince or whatever he's called. I liked him a whole lot. I liked Bashir there a lot as the Prince of Dorne. Was that his sister or his husband or his? I can't ever remember who the evil woman there is supposed to be. How she's related to anybody?
I think she's supposed to be the girl that was the lover of the Red Viper guy
that got killed by the Mountain.
That's right. I think that's who it's supposed to be.
Well, there was another character, by the way. Just when we started liking Oberyn, he gets killed by the stupid Mountain that we all hate.
Well, no, he got killed because he was a moron. He had the Mountain beat, and he was like showing off at the end, basically.
Yeah, well, again, good, even partially good people are going to get killed. There's no good deed goes unpunished.
And the Dorne thing, I thought was really, I thought it was one of the weaker parts of the season. I mean, I like him, and I think in the books he has a much better role, in that he's got these big long term plans to bring down the Lannisters and and he's got things working. But in the books, he seems like he's just kind of sitting there.
Wait. All right. So you mean, all right, in the show, you're talking about the prince in the wheelchair?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I want to make sure we switched over from Oberyn.
No, I'm sorry. In the show, Doran.
Doran, okay.
Martell is the Oberyn's brother, who's the Prince of Dorne. And in the show, I felt like he was just kind of sitting there, you know, dealing with the sand snakes and dealing with the situation, but, you know, not taking any action, not being proactive.
Right. And seemingly willfully ignorant of what her sister-in-law, whatever she is, was doing, right? I mean,
yes,
obviously was up to no good, and he's like, oh, second chances, you know, sure. He finally, like in the last episode, is like, all right, no more chances for you now. And then, of course, she immediately does what she does. All right, tell me this. That was another blow, right? Here's another pretty good, nice character. She should have known she was dead. Is she dead? What's her name?
Marcella.
Marcella, yeah.
Again, in the books, it doesn't happen this way. There is a plot involving her, she ends up getting like attacked, like a evil knight rides by and slashes her with a sword, and she gets disfigured and loses an ear and stuff. But she's not dead.
Are you kidding?
Oh, no, I'm not dead. But
disfigured, so she's gonna. Well, no, she's Tyrion's niece, so she can't marry Tyrion. I mean,
no, but and she's marrying the guy in Dorne, the son of the son. So there, you know, on the TV show, I don't know what the hell is going to happen because they're like 100 yards away on the boat. And she's dead.
Right. I'm like, slam on the brakes and go back because Jamie's got to know that, you know.
I know who did it. And I'd be like, if the princess is dead, I'm going back there. I'm going to cut that woman's head off. So.
Right. And was Bronn on the boat with him?
Yeah.
Okay. So he knows the symptoms.
The antidote.
Well, I mean, he knows the symptoms. He knows if you're bleeding from the nose and you're about to die, he knows that it's that poison that they use.
That's right.
So he'll know he can say, oh, that's the poison. Yeah, they did that to me.
But unless the boat has, you know, it goes into turbo or whatever, I don't think they're going to get back in time to give her the antidote. So.
Oh, gosh. That didn't make a lot of sense to me.
And I want to be clear, like the whole Jamie Bronn to Dorne thing is not in the books.
They send somebody else, right?
Yeah, it's another Knight of the Kingsguard. They're off doing it. And Bronn isn't even in the books anymore. He just, like, disappears. But he's such a great character, and the actor does him so well, and he and Jamie are so fun together that I don't mind him
doing
this. I like Bronn.
This was kind of the season of little on the road with frickin' Frack. You know, you had Tyrion and Varys on their road show, and then Tyrion and what's his name?
Jorah.
Yeah. And you had Bronn and Jamie. I mean, I liked all these little, you know.
Well, and then he had Pod and Brain.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, it was kind of funny. You had like Bob Hope and Bing Crosby on the road to the wall or whatever, you know, every episode pretty much. Different combinations. I actually kind of like that. It put some humor into it. What else about other minor characters and other plot lines that we did or didn't see that we should probably be thinking about?
Well, I mean, I think there's a bunch of other smaller characters and side plot lines that have been eliminated as kind of the streamlining for the TV show,
yeah,
where they try to have fewer characters and less stuff going on. And I think that worked for them. I think, you know, there's other stuff that goes on between the Lannisters and the Tyrells, and then there's other stuff, you know, that gets a whole bunch more, but and there's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on in Meereen involving, you know, the Sons of the Harpy and Daenerys's people trying to hold them off, and again in the books, like, Tyrion hasn't even gotten there yet, so that was a big, they cut through enormous amounts of kind of dilly-dallying around with that stuff, and he just kind of gets there.
That's what I was assuming. It seemed like he got there awfully quick for George R. R. Martin.
He did. Well, I mean, again, they cut out, I don't know, 1,000 pages of
good
travel and it's slavery, and, you know, they're in an army camp, and everybody's got disease, and so I didn't mind that so much. I thought it was good because you want Tyrion working for her because she doesn't have anybody working for her that knows what they're doing.
Right. Oh, absolutely. So two groups that I want to ask you about that made almost no sense to me. One I kind of get because I did read A Feast for Crows was the Sparrows, right? We had these two weird cults pop up this season, maybe more, but the Sparrows. I kind of get them. I understand. And it's the classic thing that the queen mother, Cersei, is too dumb for her own good, and she creates this army that then destroys her almost.
I lay with a man outside the bonds of marriage, I confess.
You have taken the first step on the path back to righteousness.
Am I free to go?
After your atonement.
There are symbolic aspects to the walk of atonement or the walk of shame. You're naked. You have nothing to hide. All concealment has been denied you. Your hair has all been shaved off. You're completely vulnerable. You're saying, I have nothing more to hide. I bear all before God. And that's the spiritual justification for this kind of thing. but there's also a very deliberate political aspect of it.
A sinner comes before you. Cersei of House Lannister.
People didn't see the kings and their lords very often, except when they passed by in their incredibly lavish outfits. The splendor of them, the way they glittered, helped them rule because it overawed the populace. When you take all of that away from a queen like Cersei, who up to then has only been seen by her subjects as this incredibly beautiful woman attended by maids and protected by knights, it's a way to strip her of all of the power that attends to her majesty.
Shame! 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 Shame!
Cersei is not beloved in the streets of King's Landing. This is a woman who you dare not contradict, or she could have your tongue torn out. And now people are calling her filthy names and accusations, and they're free to do so. It changes the entire public perception of her, and that is obviously part of the intent. Indeed, she goes out defiant, but she's broken and damaged by the end of it.
Well, but the other thing with the Sparrows is they are a result. I mean, again, we've had this war of all the different kings fighting with each other, and all through, like, you know, the River Run area in the west and the north and all around King's Landing and all around Storm's End and stuff, there's been all this fighting, and there's been all these armies going back and forth and back and forth. And what we've had is, you know, churches being sacked, priests being killed, nuns being killed, you know, monasteries and nunneries being attacked, and all those kind of things, and, you know, churches being looted, and, you know, people said, hey, this is wrong, and nobody, the knights weren't protecting it, the knights were involved in it, and there's a lot of just kind of lawless brigands around doing that stuff, and so a lot of it was just people saying, and people seeing the country as kind of, you know, godless, basically, that they're focusing on the wrong stuff and people trying to go back to basics a little bit from a religious sense. So that's kind of the thing with the High Sparrow, that it was in a little bit of kind of a Catholic Reformation thing too, where the church had gotten too big and the leaders were all worried, you know, we're all living in palaces and eating off gold plate. And meanwhile, people are starving and the, you know, nuns are getting raped and killed everywhere. And so then you're right. Cersei makes this really incredibly dumb mistake and allows them to rearm their military side of the church. And so now they have their own forces and they don't have to listen to anybody.
But see, in the show, we don't get any of that. We just see them suddenly pop up out of nowhere for no apparent reason. And Cersei's like, oh, I can use them to get all my enemies, and never stops to think the stuff that I'm going to have them go after my enemies for is stuff I do too.
Yeah. It's one of the ye who hath no sin cast the first stone. She has a lot of sin. She probably should have held back with the stone throwing.
Oh, Lord. Well, the other cult group is the Harpies. And the Sons of the Harpies made no sense at all to me, because it was supposed to be like rich people that didn't want Danny in charge, but yet they apparently have thousands of themselves, and they have enough money to make all these fancy masks, but yet they're rich and powerful, but yet they just hurl themselves like cannon fodder at their enemies. What is all that?
Well, I think it's supposed to be there's this whole kind of middle and upper class in Meereen that was basically made rich by the slave trade, and now she's ended it. So now all these people whose family fortunes were based off the slave trade can't make money off that anymore. And so they hate her for that. And so basically we don't know who the leader is, why they were, you know, who was the one who was telling, you know, the leading the Harpies basically. There's a couple of theories about that, but basically, you know, they were ambushing her soldiers and doing these things along the way, and then eventually, you know, attacking her. And clearly, it was all about trying to get her to leave Meereen and go back, even just leave and go to Westeros, because they didn't want her ruling them. They didn't see her as one of them. They saw her as an outsider, And they were in, you know, somebody that was working to abolish slavery, which they had all lived off of for thousands of years. And so they wanted to kill her for that.
Yeah, it just, it's never made very clear, I don't think, who the individuals are. And, you know,
No.
I just can't imagine a bunch of rich slave. It's like if it was the Confederacy, I can't imagine a bunch of Colonel Daddies and Beauregards in Tara all putting on masks and going out and being cannon fodder. You find somebody else to do that. They just seemed to come out of the woodwork. Literally, during the episodes, they would just come out of the woodwork, and you're just like, it was kind of creepy, but it didn't fit to me the setup. So also, they picked a darn fine time for this invincible army of Dannys to suddenly become completely incompetent.
Well,
I realize armies are different in cities trying to be policed than they are out on the battlefield. I get that. But they didn't look like they knew which end of the spear to poke the guy in the mask with.
No, again, there's soldiers that are trained to work together as a big unit in a phalanx kind of thing.
Right, right.
More of the way a Roman legion operates, not, you know, you're saying individual fighting, individual initiative. They're not used to operating that way. And this is why she needs Tyrion so much, is because she has all these people working for her that are very – either she doesn't trust them or they're very straightforward people like Barristan Selmy and the Unsullied. They're very straightforward kind of people. They can't deal with all this kind of treachery and plotting and backstabbing and figuring out who the bad guys are and doing the – you know, she needs Varys and she needs Tyrion to get her on track. So
yeah, well, she desperately does. And that's that. I think that was probably my favorite moment of the entire series. Of the entire season, was when Tyrion and Dany finally sat down together and had their little summit. I thought that was really fun. Just for a conversation, that was really fun because we've been building to it for 5 years, you know?
I'm not going to kill you.
No? Banish me?
No.
So if I'm not going to be murdered and I'm not going to be banished...
You're going to advise me. While you can still speak in complete sentences.
Advise you on what?
How to get what I want.
The Iron Throne. Perhaps you should try wanting something else.
If I want jokes, I'll get myself a proper fool.
I'm not entirely joking. There's more to the world than Westeros, after all. How many hundreds of thousands of lives have you changed for the better here? Perhaps this is where you belong, where you can do the most good.
I fought so that no child born into Slaver's Bay would ever know what it meant to be bought or sold. I will continue that fight here and beyond. But this is not my home.
When you get back to your home, who supports you?
The common people.
Let's be generous and assume that's going to happen. Here in Slaver's Bay, you had the support of the common people, and only the common people. What was that like? Ruling without the rich. House Targaryen is gone. Not a single person who shares your blood is alive to support you. The Starks are gone as well. Our two terrible fathers saw to that. The remaining members of House Lannister will never back you, not ever. Stannis Baratheon won't back you either. His entire claim to the throne rests on the illegitimacy of yours. That leaves the Tyrells. Not impossible. Not enough.
Lannister, Targaryen, Baratheon, Stark, Tyrell. They're all just spokes on a wheel. This one's on top, then that one's on top, and on it spins, crushing those on the ground.
It's a beautiful dream. Stopping the wheel. You're not the first person who's ever dreamt it.
I'm not going to stop the wheel. I'm going to break the wheel.
It was great.
Yeah. And not in the book, right?
Nope. He hasn't gotten there yet.
Isn't that something? Okay, and last one of the comparison things we're doing, Hardhome. Hardhome was probably the best episode of the season. It was a better 20 minutes of zombies than we've gotten in years of Walking Dead all combined, except that it didn't happen in Atlanta, but otherwise it was cool. What can you tell us about Hardhome and what we should take from it since it wasn't in the book? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, in the books, it happens, but it happens off screen. There are no first person characters there, and John gets a letter about it. But I think in the TV show, they've waited until now to make the the big threat really show itself. I mean, we've seen them, but we didn't see the, you know, there was that point where they were, where they lost a battle to the whites, but they didn't show it on the screen, where they were at the, they called it the Fist of First Men, when they were on the original big expedition with the Night's Watch and Lord Commander Mormont was still in charge. You know, there was that scene where Sam was kind of hiding and they were all walking by him. Mm-hmm. And then we wake up the next year and they've already lost the battle, basically. So we didn't see this kind of action against the Night's Watch, but they've seen it in person. And now we, the viewer, finally sees it. And you realize that, you know, oh, crap, you know, all this other stuff that's going on doesn't matter if we don't stop these people. They, you know, as long as winter keeps coming along, winter could last 10 years and these people could kill everybody.
And the thing that was frustrating to me, and I understand story purposes, but again, it feels like the plot is driving the actual characters instead of the other way around, is John, this is the scene that we should have gotten. John is like, Sam, the White Walkers are coming. They're going to kill us all. We've got to make a last ditch stand here. I'm going to need everybody I can count on right here with me. Oh, John, I've got a scholarship to this university down in South America. See ya.
Well, but I've got a scholarship to go down there and learn everything I can about dragons and White Walkers, and then I'm going to take the accelerated course and come right back. I don't think Sam's going to get the 4-year degree.
I'm going to say he better be going summers. He better be going extra hours.
But I think it's also like he's not trying to complete the degree. He's like, what courses you got on fighting White Walkers and that kind of stuff? Let me take those, and then I'm out of here.
And the Maesters are like, well, these are all purely theoretical because, of course, there are no White Walkers and they're not a danger. Now, we have some great courses on how to fight Lannisters. number one, don't act like you're a good guy because if you do, you're dead. Okay, let's look at a few of the themes that kind of run through this. Character rehabilitation. You had mentioned that to me. How do you see that playing out? Because I've seen a lot of characters getting darker. I've seen characters getting more pragmatic, like Arya, like hopefully Sansa. You know, learning from their mistakes if they're still alive. How are any of them getting sort of better, other than maybe Jaime?
Well, I think Jaime's the clearly the one that's getting better. To me, the big thing at the end of this season was the Cersei Walk of Shame thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, she has been such a terrible person, and she was such a terrible ruler as Queen Regent, basically. Running the kingdom into the ground for her own petty reasons, that, you know, seeing the way they did that, I thought was really, really good. And I thought her, you know, maybe her character gets something out of it. I don't know that.
That was an amazing sequence there where they actually have the actress, Lena Headey, totally naked. I mean, and her hair cut off and she's bleeding. And I mean,
it was a body double.
Was it?
It's to her head, but somebody else. She was actually pregnant. And
oh, okay. So, well, I mean, but I mean, in terms of the way it was staged and put together,
no, it was an amazingly well done scene. Her facial expressions, and I think that just the way the crowd and her interacted, it was incredibly well done.
Yeah, kind of makes you not really want to get into politics in Westeros, huh?
No, but I mean, even like Tyrion, you know, has had this great arc where a couple times he was going to die, and then he ends up being Hand of the King and leading, you know, everybody at that big battle and saving the city. But then he immediately gets thrown out, and then he gets accused of poisoning his nephew, and then it looks like he's, you know, going to win his trial. And then Oberyn Martell dies, and he loses his trial. They're going to execute him, but then Jaime frees him, and he kills his father. But then when he goes across the sea, he's like, "That's it. I don't care about anything anymore. I'm going to drink myself to death." And then they convince him, "Hey, you know, there's something still worth living for." And then as soon as he gets excited about that, then Jorah kidnaps him, and they get taken by slavers, and then eventually they get to Daenerys. But so I think, you know, Tyrion's had an interesting arc, and you know, he's kind of been disillusioned, but he's also kind of learned that. And what he's good at and what he wants to do and what's important in the world. Other than that, I mean, you know, Littlefinger hasn't learned anything. And maybe Theon is a character who, you know, I mean, like, you know, early on, he's the guy who sacked Winterfell and we, you know, betrayed the Starks. And so we hated him for that and basically gave the North to the Boltons. But then he went through so much terrible stuff with Ramsay that you felt bad for him, and now he saved Sansa, so maybe we're kind of like Theon again.
Well,
I certainly feel bad for him.
Well, yeah, he's been through as much as anybody, really. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them were good to start with went through a bunch of stuff and have gotten stronger. He was kind of crappy to start with and has gone through a bunch of stuff. And we'll have to see. How does Theon? Does Theon end up in the book? Kind of when he jumped. You said jumping off the wall with the fake Arya. So we don't know yet from the book either. What he's sort of become now after all this, if he's broken the conditioning and he's back to himself or a better self or what, right?
That's right.
Tell me this, by the way, what is this deal with grayscale? What is this all about? Where is this going? Why is this such an important thing?
I don't know if it is an important thing. It's kind of like leprosy, basically.
Yeah.
Or something like that, where you get these guys that were, Jorah Mormont has it,
yeah.
and it's clearly going to be fatal to him because otherwise he'll turn into those stone men or whatever they fought on the river. And so he's going to have to go down in some kind of blaze of glory pretty soon, I think. But then it can also theoretically save people and heal them like they did with the little girl.
Mm-hmm.
Stannis' little girl. So I don't know that it really means anything.
Is it going to be magical protection against dragon fire and or ice warrior people, zombies?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, it could be like another plague that breaks out when things get bad. Do you assume it's a good thing? I'm going the other way.
It's just one more bad thing. This is the Spanish flu at the end of World War I is all right. Just more ways to die. That's right. Congratulations. You survived the Wars of the Five Kingdoms. Now you got grayscale.
Mm-hmm. That's it. the White Walkers are coming, and everybody in the city has grayscale.
Good gosh. Let's see. One thing I want to ask you, we've kind of danced around this about the happy ending or a sad ending or whatever. Who do you think gets out of this alive, if anybody, that we care about? From where we stand right now. Zombie John and maybe Tyrion and Dany?
I mean, yes. And I would say out of that, even maybe just Dany.
Hmm. Is she the ultimate winner?
I think so.
Back in Targaryen hands, we have the restoration. Restoration.
But could you also see a situation where, if she had to, get on her dragon and go attack the White Walkers to sacrifice herself to save all her people, she'd do that in a minute.
Well, I'll tell you what I want to see. I think that there's another continent to the west of Westeros, and it's a much more technologically advanced continent. And so just when things are at their worst, the armored personnel carriers start landing on the beaches like D-Day and the Napoleon/Eisenhower character rolls in and invades and says, "You people are all stupid. I'm taking over." And he has like asbestos armor so the dragons can't hurt him, and he's immune to ice. That's why I just want to see it. So does George R. R. Martin know where this is going, or is he making it up as he goes along?
It's a great question. I hope he knows where it's going. I mean, I think he knows where it's going he has it outlined out to the end. And he knows, what's going to happen to the major characters and how he's going to bring everything home. But, the details of what's going to happen, clearly he doesn't because the books aren't finished. So, mm-hmm. But I think he knows at a basic level where how the characters are going to advance and how they're going to, how Dany and Tyrion and everybody's going to get back to Westeros with the dragons and whatever army they have. And then eventually things are going to go with the White Walkers, which I'm going to be honest. I think things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. You think things are bad now, but the next book is called The Winds of Winter. And I think winter is coming in the Stark words. And I think, everything is going to be under snow. There's not going to be any food. People are going to be starving. And I think the White Walkers are going to get past the wall, and then it's open season on humans. So,
and the interesting thing, the only glimmer of hope in that is that winter actually the Starks are like the Russians, where winter is their general. General Winter fights for the Starks usually.
against humans that works well.
Oh, Lord. Let's talk about the Winds of Winter. What are you kind of expecting to happen, and what do you want to happen, and what are you afraid is going to happen that we haven't already kind of talked about?
Well, man, I guess one thing is I'm afraid the book's not going to come out before the next TV season. There is no release date set for this book.
Well, there was a rumor a couple of days ago that he may have finished it, but may have just be the first draft, and then he had to go through edits and all that.
That's what I'm saying. I suspect it's probably with his editors, but I think there hasn't been a release date set, which means I don't think it'll happen this calendar year. I think it could happen in early 2016, you know, February, March, somewhere there, so they could get it out before the TV show. So I think that's kind of their goal, I'm sure. Whether they can do that or not, I don't know. But
well, let's for the listeners that don't know this, let's kind of and correct me if I'm wrong, but if people are wondering, well, how was the TV show guys Benioff and Weiss? How were they able to know what to do?
Well, I mean, because they part of it was the deal they made when they started the TV show. Was they sat down with him and said, okay, you know, we're going to do this TV show over this many seasons. And at some point, if we pass the books, you got to work with us. And this TV show has been so successful, you know, that I think he's very happy about that. And at some point he said, okay, I'm going to tell you the rest of the story, basically, and you can just run with it and adjust it as you need to for the TV show. And that's what they did.
But then he reserves the right to go back and change it later in the books, right?
Sure.
We could end up with two completely different stories, basically, which I don't think is a bad idea.
I don't think it's a bad idea either. And I think there are going to be, just like with this thing with Stannis, I think there are going to be substantive differences between what happens in the books, what happens in the TV show. But I think we're going to get the, you know, the core of where it's going out of both of them. I think it would be really funny if he wrote a completely different ending for the books.
Well, it will definitely make me want to go back and read the books. I'm just going to enjoy the show without having the show kind of spoiled. I know it sounds kind of backwards, but I'd like to enjoy the show as a show and not know, you know, just sort of like watching the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies. I sat through six long movies that I knew everything that was going to happen pretty much.
Well, so not the Hobbit movies, because none of those are in the book.
I know, but still the basic strokes of it. Whereas with this, I don't have any idea now, and I'm enjoying that. So,
well, what do you want to happen in the next TV season, and what do you think is going to happen?
You know, here's the thing I wrestle with. If they see everybody's like, oh, don't worry, they'll bring John back. They'll bring John back. I'm like, I don't want to root for zombie John. I liked regular John. Mm-hmm. I don't want John to be like the big Lord Commander. Zombie John, what should we do?
Brains.
Yeah, I don't want that. We were just rapidly running out of characters I care about, and so and I feel like a lot of the ones I do care about, they're still spinning their wheels. I mean, Dany is just, I'm so tired of her being in this big city. She spent like half the last season. And all it seems like that she got to those cities like in the second season, and it's just been I do enjoy Tyrion and her working together, the brief little bit we got of that, but the reason I enjoy it, aside from just the dialogue, is because it gives me a hope that they're gonna do something.
Yeah, she's got
I want some forward movement, honestly, at this point. I just want something to develop. Other than status quo or internal civil war round and round and round.
I think things are going to move forward. I mean, he has to, because then he only has two books left. But I think – and I have some theories about how that could happen. But actually, fans of the books – and they've actually called this the Myrinese Knot, like K-N-O-T.
Yeah.
Because he brings so many threads together there, and then it all kind of gets stuck. I mean, the plot has really stuck there and stuck her there. But part of the problem is he sent, you know, not just Tyrion and Jorah Mormont, but there's all these other characters that aren't even in the TV show who are going in her direction, who are coming for her, and good and bad. And so that, you know, isn't helping move it forward. And we need her out of there. We need that situation settled. We need her moving on to Westeros.
Yes. Yeah, I just honestly don't think that's ever going to happen at this point. It just seems like she's a complete. It was that way with the books, and it's that way with the show. It just seems like she's a completely different show, a completely different story. That's why when Tyrion shows up, it's like, oh, this is so bizarre seeing somebody from the other show. It's almost like you're watching a Batman show and Superman shows up, which we're going to get next year. So that's kind of cool. I've decided in the course of this show now. I've decided that even though he's on double secret probation now and hanging by a fingernail, I'm going to give the show and the books one more chance with season six. And he so much as harms a hair on the head of anybody left that I care about, I may be checking out. But honestly, the burning of the little girl was pretty much the next to last straw for me. And then killing Jon Snow was disappointing. But just the idea that they can just so casually do that just really made me sick, and I'm just very disappointed in the whole thing for it. So I, you know, should I feel that way? I mean,
no, it's completely understandable. It really is. It's you know, it's like, how many times do we have to go through this and feel this way to feel like this is, you know, again, yeah, like you were saying, it's not a, what are we getting out of it?
Well, I mean, I have to sit there on the couch with my wife and watch it, and I'm embarrassed. You know, I'm like looking over at her like, I didn't know this was going to happen. I'm really sorry. This is terrible. Like, oh my gosh, you know. So it just makes me very uncomfortable all the way around. So, and having, you know, daughters too doesn't help. You the same way.
Sure.
All right. I guess let's move toward a conclusion then, and verdict. Where are you feeling? How are you feeling about the show now? We've kind of walked through it. We've white walked through it.
Well, I think that, I mean, this show, as I said at the beginning, I think this season floundered around a little bit. I think there was the ending was strong. Hard Home was great. You know, absolutely one of the best episodes. One that really got your attention. But overall, I mean, I think this show, this season wasn't as good as some of the other seasons. And I think some of that was, you know, them running out of material and kind of improvising on their own. And some of it was that honestly, the fourth book is the worst book by far.
Yeah.
And they made the good decision to throw 99% of that out and not use it. And so then the, you know, what they used is a little bit of the fourth book and, you know, so a lot of the fifth book, which is good, but it's not as good as like books two and three. So right. I think that's part of it, is the source material isn't as good at this point, and that's dragging the show down a little bit. But
yeah, somebody made the point that this season seemed to both go too fast and too slow at the same time. And it sounds confusing until you actually watch it, but I bet you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. There were times when you're like, come on, let's move it along. And then you look up and 100 things happen and it's over. So,
yeah. So, all right. So we'll be back for season six, but we're not thrilled so far. Right. I mean, we're feeling like there's reasons for it, but. Nah.
Well, but at the same time, I mean, I love the books. I'm all in. I'm reading the books. I'm going to watch the show to the end, and then I'm going to read the books, you know, whether he finishes them or he, you know, passes away and somebody else finishes them for him. So
you're all in regardless to see what happens, right?
Yep. As dark as it gets.
I was until they burned the little girl. Now he's on double secret probation. All right. Well, that's been our look at Game of Thrones, and I find myself surprised. I was as huge a fan as anybody, you know, up through the third book, and I kind of got a little disappointed with the fourth one. Haven't read the fifth one, but except for bits and pieces. I've enjoyed the show up until this season, but let's just say next season, George, Benioff, Weiss, let's get it right this time. Let's get it going. So, all right, any final words or thoughts before we close it out?
Nope. You know, what do we say to the god of death? Not today.
Not today. Will I quit watching the show? Not today.
That's it.
All right. Don't forget to check out www.whiterocketbooks.com. Like I said, I've got a 6-volume and growing science fiction series and a 7-volume and growing superhero novel series. And there are other great books by other authors there as well. including our football book that John and I, two of our football books that John and I wrote. So, John, I appreciate you coming on tonight. It's always a pleasure. And I guess we will be talking again in about a year when we see what they've done with season 6. So,
looking forward to it.
All right. The Rocket's going to get on out of here for another week. We will see you all down the road.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.